And I do want to say also, you know, back to the human piece and about specific behavior changes, what we're actually doing when we're talking about learning and memory is to, we're laying down memories, we're establishing patterns which encode the whole context. So the mood that you're in when you learn stuff is encoded in the material that you learn. That's part of the reason why very good teachers often have such a positive effect on someone. It's partly to do with their teaching skills, but it's often to do with just, you remember just feeling so great when you were learning this stuff, and when these facts come back to you, that feeling, that wellness, that comes back as well. And so I do think that building humor into the encode, what we call in memory, in the encoding context, means that when you're trying to retrieve memories, hey, what was it I was supposed to do when I get an email from someone I don't recognize? Oh yeah, it's the thing. Oh yeah, that was that funny joke. You know, that actually you've got the gag in there as well as the behavior.
And welcome to Fishy Business, a series dedicated to exploring the lesser-known side of cybersecurity. I'm Alice.
And I'm Brian, and we're colleagues at Mimecast. Every episode, we'll be joined by a special visitor who's definitely not your average guest to share tales of risk, reward, and ridiculousness.
We'll be looking for new ways to think about cybersecurity to learn how we can all improve in the fight to stay safe.
Alice, I generally do dad jokes, but do you remember the last joke that I told you?
I'm not sure I do actually, Brian, but I think I can see where you're going with this.
Yeah, I thought you might. On the podcast today, we're talking all things cybersecurity awareness training and how we can best retain information, which might indeed involve humor.
We have two illustrious guests to help us with this. We're joined by Mike Gruen, a CSO and CTO, assisting early and growth stage companies to achieve their security and technology goals. And Daniel Glazer, who is a neuroscientist, a writer, and was founding director of Science Gallery London, Winston Churchill Fellow 2019.
Wow, thank you so much. Thank you both so much for joining us and welcome.
So we can't wait to get stuck in. It sounds like you both have incredibly fascinating jobs, but we always like to potentially start from the beginning a little bit. Mike, how about we start with you? How would you explain your job, for example, to somebody at a dinner party?
So yeah, my job is really all things security. So it's overlooking everything from physical security to application security and how organizations, specifically startups and early stage come secure, not just the things that they're building, but also their office and all of the infrastructure and technology that they use internally to do their jobs as well.
Wow, fascinating. That sounds like a very broad spectrum of...
Yes, all things security.
Absolutely. And Dr. Glazer, can I call you Daniel? How would you describe your job at a dinner party, for example?
So I'm a science communicator. I still think of myself as a neuroscientist because I did 15 years of research and, you know, I think that's it for life, basically.
Wow.
But my day job is, I'm currently, in fact, at the Royal Institution in London, but my job is to take science of all kinds, for myself it's neuroscience, but other types as well, and bring it into a space where a particular audience can relate to it in their own terms.
Maybe let's drill down onto you a little bit. Could you tell us a little bit more about yourself? How did you get your start in technology?
Went to the University of Maryland at College Park as a comp sci major and got my start in the 90s when the internet was first taking off and web was new. And I've been doing application development for 20 some odd years. I've really worked always in that area between application development, infrastructure, security, deployments, all of that. Have just been doing that ever since. Most recently worked as a VP of engineering and CISO in charge of application development and security.
Wow, that's incredible. And Daniel, from your perspective, how did you start off in your career? How did you get into neuroscience in the first place? And how have you found that's developed throughout your career?
So I was originally, in fact, a programmer when I was very young, embarrassingly young, in fact. In those days, it was called hacking, meant what coding means now. So I was a hacker, but not in the black hat, white hat sense. But then I did maths at university, got bored, switched to English. So I'm kind of always been interested in the kind of storytelling or joke telling, as we might do today, as well as the scientific stuff. But then a master's in knowledge-based systems. So I was interested in how to make artificial brains and machine learning. And my PhD and postdoc were neuroscience. And so that's how the scientific kind of trajectory went.
If you look at some studies around the cyber skills gap, And that's been estimated variously to be some fairly big numbers in the millions. I think the biggest one I've seen has been around about 4 to 5 million. And I guess that also really just depends on how you measure that. But let's start with you, Mike. How do you think and what do you think can actually help reduce this whole cyber skills gap?
That's a great question. There's whole companies, you know, sort of dedicated to it. The last company I was working with, Cybrary, is trying to tackle that problem as well. There's a couple of different ways to attack it. I think one is obviously trying to make it more accessible for more people to get into careers in cybersecurity. That's one of the keys, I think, is it can be very expensive and very daunting. Saying you want to get into cybersecurity is like saying you want to be a doctor. There's so many specialties. It's just sort of a meaningless thing to say. And so I think the more we can do to educate people and help train people and really bend that curve down to make it easier for people to get into the careers, that's one thing. I think we're already seeing it on the automation, and I want to be careful about like saying things too much about AI and machine learning and the rest of it, but just generally this notion of automating and really making it so that have people spending more time doing what people do best, as opposed to, you know, things that can be analyzed and computers can separate noise from, you know, signal. That's where we want to be. And so there's a lot of happening on the tech side of things. And then also, I think recognition from companies that really cybersecurity overall, it's becoming more of everyone in the organization is becoming more and more sort of important into it. And, you know, we're going to be talking about security awareness and security awareness training. And I think everybody can impact cybersecurity at their organization and recognizing that it's not just some department, but rather educating everyone to make good decisions and align to company goals and what's important and securing the crown jewels, if you will, or whatever, and understanding the impacts of their decisions, that goes a long way as well. Because I think the more people understand those problems, the less need you have for cybersecurity specialists, if you will. But it's definitely a daunting problem that a lot of companies are tackling in a lot of different ways.
Absolutely. And Daniel, I think from a STEM subjects perspective, say, for example, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, what do you think we could do to maybe generate in the children of today's generation, you know, their interest and potentially girls in particular, and bringing them through those routes to help target, say, the skills gap that Brian and Mike have been mentioning?
Yeah, it's very interesting. There's some very interesting international comparative data on this, in fact. So there's an interesting study called ROSE, R-O-S-E, which is Research on Science Education, and it's out of Norway. And what they've done is to take measures of how interested young people are in a career in STEM. And they've correlated that. They've plotted that on a graph. This is an audio thing, so my hand waving is entirely irrelevant, but they're plotting it on a graph on the y-axis. And across the bottom, they plot a thing called Human Development Index, which is how develops your country is in terms of infant mortality or GDP per head or level of education globally. And what they find is a minus 0.94 correlation. And what does that mean? It means that countries which are really developed, Finland, I don't know, UK, US, everyone just wants to be on the X factor, right? I mean, they want to have their own podcast series. That's basically the great, they want to be an influencer. In Uganda, right? Everyone wants to be a scientist, right? And it's very interesting because if the 0.94 minus 0.94 correlation means that, you know, most of the points are really, really near the line on that. And yet different countries take very different strategies in terms of how they try to persuade young people to choose STEM subjects or computer science or cyber skills. And what the statistic shows you is it doesn't really matter what you do nationally to try and change people's minds. It's actually a function of development. But I do think that popular culture is super relevant. So we know, for example, in the UK, and I believe there's a similar thing in the US, there was a TV series called CSI, Crime Scene Investigators, which is all about forensics. And at one point in the UK, there were 10 times as many people studying forensics at university as there were not vacancies, but actual jobs in forensics nationally, right? 10 times as many people studying it as there are roles altogether, not vacancies. Now, from my point of view, that's kind of hilarious, but also fine, because forensics is a STEM subject. And so in a way, I don't really mind what it is that drives people to do things. I don't mind popular culture. I don't know, you know, whether black hat to white hat is a thing in cybersecurity or not. But if people want to romanticize the outlaw and then realize that actually they can make money more reliably by becoming a good guy, however their route is in, I think you've just got to bring it to life in a space that people can relate to on a personal level.
And I guess Hollywood does a lot of that. They put beautiful people into lab coats and kind of make the job look attractive. But part of the problem there is they then put too much emphasis in the wrong place. And we see a lot of that. I mean, is there not maybe too much emphasis on things like STEM? Should we not also be looking at psychology and human behavior? When you look at things like cybersecurity awareness training, we tend to kind of go for the stereotypes and these sort of stereotypical types of things. And people have the wrong idea of the kind of skill sets that are needed in cybersecurity. I mean, Mike, do you agree with that view?
Yeah, I mean, I very much agree with that. I think over my career, at Maryland, I studied both computer science and I had a minor in poetry. That creative outlet, that creative aspect is an important part. And I think what I hire people, the fact that they're musicians and they're, as a hobby, or maybe they're an artist as a hobby, or they studied in school. I think those are all important things to bring to the table. I think STEM is great, but at the same time, there's so much creativity that needs to happen in technology. And that's another way we're going to sort of solve the problem, making the interaction between humans and computers more human oriented. And you don't get that purely from a math and hard sciences background. You need to start getting into some of the social, some of the softer sciences or whatever you want to call them. I don't want to upset anyone. And then also into, other aspects like literature and art and music. I think those are all very valuable skills to bring to the table.
But Mike, I think for you, how would you say we can, considering this array of different people within companies, we're talking about cyber specialists, and then if we're looking at the actual employees and making them care about cybersecurity and moving towards that awareness training piece, how do you think we can get people to care more about what happens with cybersecurity and their responsibility, even if they think, well, I'm not in the cybersecurity space per se?
Yeah, that's, I think, one of the keys. I think we've sort of seen it trending this way as well, which is that security is in the past, I think, seen as the department that says no. They sort of create roadblocks and obstacles. And the more the sort of security, whoever's in charge of that, can really change their mentality towards a culture of yes, like how do we find a way to yes, how do we do this is an important part. And then also really connecting the why should I follow these rules, or why am I doing what I'm doing? Connecting that to people's jobs. I think people overall make good decisions when they are given the right information. I mean, nobody sets out to create, to be that vulnerability or be that risk, right? And so I think it's really making it easier for people to do the right thing, easier for people to connect why doing that right thing is better for them in the long run. Whether it's, in a lot of cases, it's tough to connect the dots between what you're doing day to day and sort of the cybersecurity aspects. And I think that's where awareness training, historical awareness training, which just sort of goes over the do's and don'ts, fall short, as opposed to more story oriented and more things that can sort of show cause effect. And the better you can sort of make it stick in people's mind with humor and other things, I think are all important aspects of it.
So didn't we kind of as an industry shoot ourselves in the foot to some extent by referring to it as awareness training, when really what we're looking for is behavioral change?
Naming things is always hard. I think that's the hardest thing in computer science. But have we shot ourselves in the foot? I don't know. I do think that we do need to move more towards beyond awareness. I think simple awareness training is, we need to move beyond that to behavioral training and connecting the dots.
And then Daniel, maybe why does some, let's just call it awareness training because that's what it's called. Why does some awareness training really seem to work and some awareness training not? I mean, I'll give you one interesting statistic. At Mimecast, during the pandemic, we suddenly noticed this massive uptick in users clicking on malicious links that they hadn't been doing before. There was a material change in that. And what was even more interesting was those end users who had Mimecast awareness training were 5 times less likely to click on a malicious link. But even end users who had other awareness training other than ours were less likely, but it varied by vendor quite dramatically. And I won't mention any names, but it was just interesting seeing that some awareness training really seemed to make a difference and some made virtually no difference at all.
So awareness training, you can think of in many ways. And by the way, I think the distinction between awareness training and behavior changes is really significant here, because if we think about risky behaviors that we do in our own lives, you know, I'm very aware of the dangers of drinking more alcohol than I should, which is something that I fairly regularly do, but it doesn't change my behavior at all. So I think we can make a distinction. But I think if we think about awareness, it's probably instructive to think about two different things in terms of neuroscience. So the first is about perception and what we would call the direction of attention. And one of the easiest ways of studying this is in terms of eye movements. So your eyes, fastest muscle in your body, and what you do with your eyes is that you look at things that are of importance to you. And the reason why you look directly at things that are of importance is that the center of your visual system, what we call the fovea, but the very center of the camera at the back of your eyes, is much more sensitive than the periphery, than the edges. And so in fact, the periphery is really about telling you where to look. And once you've seen that there's something interesting, you look over at it, and then you can see what it is. So for example, you can't really see color. You certainly can't read in the edge of your vision, only in the center. Now, if you study people's eye movements, that tells you what they're interested in. And in fact, expertise, becoming an expert in something, which is something that training can give you, is really easily demonstrated in the way that people's eyes move. And so a classic example of this was if you take a historian of art, somebody who's studied art a lot, and you look at her eye movements when she's looking at a picture, right? And you compare that with the eye movements of a naive person like me, she's looking at different places on the picture than I am. Now, interestingly, I would imagine, and you guys are the experts, that if an email pops up in front of me, where do my eyes go to when I get that email? Does it look at the sender? Do I open that out and look down the chain of the URL? Do I look in the links? Do I hover before I click and so on? How do I direct my attention? And so expertise is really about learning where to look as much as learning what it is you're looking for.
At Mimecast, we actually also have our own cybersecurity training solution that we look to make videos that are purposefully funny and delivered a bit like a sitcom in kind of short episodes and easy for people to grasp. We often feel that humor in that way helps make a stickiness for the employees. It helps them better, you know, remember the information that we're trying to deliver to them. What are your thoughts on that in terms of that neurological side of things?
Well, look, the first thing to say about humor is that we don't understand how it works and that many scientists are funny, but many really are not. And if neuroscience was better at understanding it, neuroscientists would be a lot funnier than they are. Interestingly, actually, I mean, you know, Dr. Freud, Sigmund Freud, you know, the father of psychoanalysis, he thought, and in many ways you'd think that psychoanalysis would be a really good, you know, the study of repressed desires and hidden thoughts and so on. He has a lot of theories about humor. But one of the things that really undermines Freud's theories about humor is that the jokes that he uses to illustrate the chapter on humor are really not funny. And that's very undermining of his sense of what humor is all about. So we know, you know, we know some things about what's going on when you find things funny, but we certainly don't have a neurobiological definition of it. Here are some things we do know about humor. One of the main things that's associated with it is the violation of expectation. Things don't turn out like you expect them to. And I think in terms of training people to modify their behavior, that sense of things are not what they seem, that you're led, as it were, up one path and then it leads you to a place you didn't expect, that kind of flexibility of thought, that openness to things having double meanings, puns and double entendres, the thing of you being suckered into believing one thing when it's actually another. I think that kind of flexibility is very important. And our learning, folks, is context dependent. So if you learn something in one context, you recall it more easily in that context. And so if we can take the kinds of expectations that people might have if they were being told a joke in a comedy club, and we can recreate some of that in the context of opening up an email or deciding whether to click on a link in a website, we can bring these natural skills of violation of expectation and, you're having a laugh, into the context of your online life. And so I think bringing models of experience and perception, which are already extant, into a different context is probably a really important element of why your training programs, as you say, seem to be successful.
Absolutely. And Mike, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak, you know, very anecdotally. I don't have the scientific research to back this up, but as someone who has, you know, overseen security awareness training deployments and participated in my fair share of them, and can, you know, very openly and transparently, we use Mimecast. I've used it now twice at two different companies. I like the way that it's delivered. And I think the feedback I've gotten from staff is, hey, you know, awareness training generally is not great, but of all of the ones I've ever done, this is actually enjoyable. And I think there's that enjoyability. I think having done the other ones where it's just, you know, whatever it is, if it's not enjoyable, you're just trying to get through it as quickly as possible, just trying to check the box. And I know people, you know, this might sound like a commercial or whatever, but there are people who have told me that they actually look forward to the awareness training each month, the modules. And I think
I've heard that a lot. Yeah. we have other customers that say that as well.
And even as Daniel was talking, I was trying to take what he was saying and put it into the context of what I've seen. And I think the accessibility of it, the fact that like it's filmed in the videos take place in an office setting. There's the sort of back and forth conversation, the framing of it in a way that makes it entertaining, but also connects you to the situation, I think really does help, as opposed to the more cut and dry ones where it's just questions and answers. What do you do in this situation? What do you do in that situation? Those, you're never in that situation. Like it's, you don't connect those dots. And then the other ones that I've seen where they try and do more situational type things are still really bad plays. And it's too narrowly focused on the situation and not more broadly on some of the banter that happens in an office and some of the other things, or going out to happy hour or some of those other things. I think bringing all those aspects in to bear make it much easier for you to sort of put yourself in the position of the people in the video and also remember it later when a situation arises. I can tell you that Human Error, the character, is a very popular person, both offices I worked at. And, you know, we have memes in our Slack workspaces, you know, for him. And so I think that there's a connection there because you can sort of relate.
You know, maybe to move on to something a little bit more specific and some examples of some of these behaviors. And we've seen recent reports of criminal gangs trying to recruit company insiders to help them get access to their networks. And the media unfortunately portrays these insiders either, there's almost like a sort of a give in to the dark side of the force kind of thing at play. But the reality is it's probably a lot more complex. So we've seen examples, and then equally we've seen people working in contact centers in mobile operators who've actually help criminal syndicates do things like SIM swapping and that. What actually motivates employees to act in this way? What's the driving force there? And is it a lot more complex than just the good and bad kind of narrative that the media tries to portray? I mean, I'll start with you, Daniel.
Well, I mean, if you'd like the neuroscientist's account of moral behavior, you may have to wait a few years. But I think one of the things that psychology can certainly tell us, and there is some neuroscientific evidence for this, is that moral decisions are not made in a vacuum. But rather in a social context. And people make decisions based on role models and on their perceptions of what others will think. And so it's very rare when it comes to a dilemma that people are actually sitting down like Aristotle and weighing up the good and the bad and what's the thing. I think it's a lot about values. So, you know, the values in the context where you live. And Aristotle himself believed that. He thought that right living was something that you could teach to some extent, but a lot of it, you know, came from, you know, just a good upbringing and being lucky in life. But certainly the social cognition, the sense of, you know, being observed or not. For example, there are some really nice moral experiments where even having a pair of cartoon eyes in front of you, you know, stuck to the wall or stuck to your screen, makes people behave in a more moral fashion. And that's not just the risk of being caught, but really the sense of being judged. So I think the sense of whether others will perceive what you're doing and what their response might be is at the heart of many of the decisions that people end up making.
So, Mike, maybe from a cybersecurity awareness and behavioral training sort of standpoint, apart from cartoon eyes, how can companies minimize this? What kind of strategies can they employ?
Oh, so yeah, I mean, before I get to that, I think having worked on a user entity behavioral analytics platform and looking at this sort of what drives risk and risky individuals and stuff, it is a rich tapestry of causes. I think there's a lot of things that go into whether or not someone, you know, sort of helps the criminals. And I think there's you know, there's compromised insiders, there's all kinds of reasons why you might help the criminal organization. In a lot of cases, they're doing it by accident, or if they're making moral or ethical choices, it's what's perceived as, what can I get away with, but what are the norms, or are the rules overly, if the rules are overly draconian, and I think this gets into the question that you were asking, which is, if you have overly draconian rules, then people will sort of see those rules as not needing to be followed, which means less severe rules or guidelines are also therefore even easier to sort of not follow. And I think you need to make sure that you're approaching it from a, how do you enable people to do their jobs and do it efficiently in secure ways is really at the heart of it. And I think a little bit like, as Daniel was talking, I was thinking about people speeding on the road. Like, it's against the law to speed, right? But yet it's socially acceptable to speed, at least in the DC area, where speed limits, if you actually drive the speed limit, you'll actually get like run off the road. So I think I think that gets into that sort of morals and ethics and helping people do the right thing. If you really want to help people do the right thing and you're trying to solve it from a technical problem, then it's really approaching it from their perspective. How are they, why are they doing what they're doing, and how do you help them to make the right choices? I'm not sure if that exactly answers your question, but I think that's really part of it.
No, I think that was great.
There's actually good evidence from psychology, just building on what Mike's saying, about reward and punishment. It's, I dare say, in parenting, there's perhaps only one rule of parenting, isn't there, which is reward the good, ignore the bad. And that just shows you that awareness and behavior change are not the same, because I've been aware of that for many years and hasn't changed my behavior at all. But, I think that rewards change behavior much more effectively than punishments. And I do want to say also, back to the humor piece and about specific behavior changes, what we're actually doing when we're talking about learning and memory we're laying down memories, we're establishing patterns which encode the whole context. So the mood that you're in when you learn stuff is encoded in the material that you learn. And that's part of the reason why very good teachers often have such a positive effect on someone. It's partly to do with their teaching skills, but it's often to do with just, you remember just feeling so great when you were learning this stuff. And when these facts come back to you, that feeling, that wellness, that comes back as well. And so I do think that building humor into the encode, what we would call in memory, in the encoding context, means that when you're trying to retrieve memories, hey, what was it I was supposed to do when I get an email from someone I don't recognize? Oh yeah, it's the thing. Oh yeah, that was that funny joke. That actually you've got the gag in there as well as the behavior. And again, because memory is holistic, because you encode all elements of the context in which you learn something, it makes very good sense to build the reward into the package of technical knowledge that you're trying to convey.
I think that's interesting, because the whole award thing, one of the things that I learned from another cybersecurity professional another CSO who's sort of helping me in my career, one of the things he mentioned was that he likes to point out when people made the right decision, right? Like publicly acknowledge when someone did the right thing, rather than just the punishment of not following the rules. Or similarly, the most important thing I think you get from awareness training is awareness of what to do. It's not just about don't click the link. It's what do you do once you click the link? Do you try and put it under the rug and pretend like nothing happened and back away slowly? Or do you, immediately report like, I messed up? And so being able to, make sure that people understand what to do when they make a mistake, and make sure that they're not scared to make mistakes or scared to say, I messed up, is an important part of security. And I think rewarding people for doing the right thing, which in this case, the right thing isn't whether or not they clicked the link. It's, did they tell someone that they messed up? That's an important part. And it's not just about punishing people and making people feel bad and so scared to do anything that they don't click any links. It's really the reaction after the fact that's an important part as well.
And to be honest, I would say that's an important, culture that needs to be bred into everything. And if we're looking into things like phishing emails and impersonation attacks, for example, my colleagues listening to this will probably be chuckling because I love talking about impersonation, where cyber criminals essentially try to trick users into clicking on malicious links or divulging sensitive information or transferring large amounts of money, for example, where they think that the message has come from somebody that's being impersonated. Attackers often use social engineering tactics to make the attacks obviously more harder to spot. Why do you think these tactics work so well, and what can we potentially be doing about it to try to erase somebody falling for these, for example? And I think, Mike, if we start with you.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to recognize, and I attended a great Black Hat topic on this that was hosted on this, and I can't remember who the speaker was, but she was saying how basically you can't rely on everyone to be vigilant 100% of the time. Like, that idea, always remaining vigilant, is just, it's not our human nature. And I think, so with that in mind, people want to be helpful. People under stress want to be helpful and then potentially make the wrong decision. You got that email from your boss. Oh, you know, you don't really necessarily put it all together and take that breath and take that step back.
There's so much more that I'd love to talk to you about, and we definitely need to get both of you back on the podcast. And, you know, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. We always like to end our episodes by asking our guests three simple questions.
So, Mike, if we maybe start with you, looking back over your career, what's the one insight that you'd wish you'd learned sooner, or that you could maybe go back and tell your younger self?
I think it actually ties into what we just talked about, which is that emotional awareness, the sort of the mindfulness of the state and not being reactive, recognizing that for the most part, everything I've worked on, situations, you can take a beat, you can just relax, get it, you know, and understand what's going on and make a good decision. I think that would, if I could go back and tell my younger self, that would be definitely one of them.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. And Daniel, what about you?
The thing I wish I'd learned earlier is that anyone can write a terrible first draft. So when you're trying to write a thing, you focus on making a great piece of writing. And what you need to focus on is making a really terrible first draft. And if that's your goal and you set out to do that, really execute that, make a terrible first draft and then revise it. I would have written a lot more things in my life if I'd learned that earlier.
Oh, brilliant. Great advice. Thank you so much.
And Daniel, that sort of takes us nicely from writing to reading. We're actually starting to build a really interesting list that our guests have been recommending to us on this podcast. So I'll extend reading to listening, because I see that seems to be a thing now. It's not something I really try and do when it comes to books. But what are you reading or listening to at the moment that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Indeed. Well, I do. The first point I would say is the other proud moment of my life, I was a judge on a thing called the Booker Prize, which is the preeminent prize for novels. I was the first scientist to be a judge on that. And that did put me off novels for quite a while. I had to read 186 novels in 6 months, which very nearly killed me. But I found a way back, and I'm now back on novels. And so I think reading novels to understand domains is a really powerful thing to do. I'm reading a lot of novels by young Black writers from the African subcontinent, from sub-Saharan Africa at the moment. I'm reading a book called Americana, with an H at the end at the moment, which is a story of a young woman's journey back to Nigeria. And for me, the generic piece here is that if you want to find out about a domain, read a novel rather than a textbook.
I think that's great advice. I always start reading historical novels when I want to find out about a particular era, and then eventually move on to the books. And often the novels are just a lot better, albeit slightly less accurate because of the sort of necessity to kind of condense things. Mike, what about you? What sorts of things would you recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, I've been reading a lot on more leadership-oriented books that help with that do talk about behavior and what drives people and how to motivate and how to help people. And then also mindfulness, which is interesting because I think our last point of the podcast was a little bit on that as well, which is this, you know, taking that breath and being more aware of the thoughts in your head and being more focused. So I'm doing a lot more on that stuff right now.
That's great. Thank you so much. And looking into the future, maybe this time next year, where do you think we'll be in terms of cybersecurity training, and what trends do you think we'd be spotting? So maybe, Mike, if we start with you.
you know, what trends? I think in terms of training, I think we're going to start seeing things hopefully broaden out a little bit more, more training that's a little more focused on maybe more specific to people's domains. So I think we take a very generalized approach for a lot of training and don't really have something that's really specific to marketing or specific to sales. And I think we're going to start seeing a little bit more of that specificity and more behavioral, less on awareness and more on behavior and understanding the cause effect and what to do and stuff like that. I think that's areas. And hopefully, you know, we'll continue to see trends in technology improvements to just make it easier for people to do their jobs and stuff like that, and understand the implications of the decisions they're making that are broader than just don't click the link and, you know, know who you're talking to and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. And I think from our perspective, you know, the difference that we've seen in the last few years in comparison to the last, say, 10 years has been absolutely huge. So I can imagine the next year we'll also see great strides in that direction as well. And Daniel, what about you? What's your perspective for the future?
Well, I'm thinking about that experiment that Microsoft did a while back with that paperclip that used to pop up on the screen. And what that was trying to do was to work out not just what people were trying to do, but what their mood was. And I remember the paperclip would kind of be going, "You appear to be getting slightly irritated." And that's because this paperclip be popping up. But I do think that, you know, if you remember the prove you're not a robot, and it's gone down a bit of a rabbit hole now in terms of image classification, but the original version of it, as you remember, was you simply had to click on the box to prove you're not a robot. And the reason was because the patterns of movement of a trackpad or of a mouse to move the pointer to the box were very, very difficult back then for robots to spoof. Now, that's not the point I think is interesting here. I think what's interesting is that there are characteristic patterns in the latencies with which we click on things, the movements of our mouse and our scrolling, which tell the system a lot about our emotional responses to things. And so I think there are privacy concerns around that, but I think we'll start to see much more flags being raised when people are clicking things on non-typical ways. If you're clicking on a business communication as if it were a social one, that's a flag that you're being played in some way. And so I think we can get more out of our interfaces. And I'm sure we're going to see more of that in the way that security firms can flag behavior amongst users, which is something that they ought to be concerned about.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us today on this week's Fishy Business. And also thank you to all of our listeners for joining us as well. It's definitely been a pleasure having all of you with us today. If you have enjoyed our podcast, please do leave us a review on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you're hearing this. And feel free to follow us on our Twitter page @Mimecast if you'd like to learn more about what we discussed. Until next time.